Dream of the Red Chamber, Chapter 110.
So imagine you are the chief operating officer of this massive billion-dollar legacy brand.
Right.
And your legendary CEO just died. The government is actively auditing your finances. Your entire frontline staff is basically on a wildcat strike. And you are literally coughing up blood from stress on the office floor.
It's a lot.
Yeah, but welcome to the year 1791.
Which, you know, paints quite a picture, doesn't it? And I think it completely shatters this illusion we have that organizational collapse is like a modern invention, or that it's this clean clinical process you can just track on a spreadsheet.
Right, because usually when we talk about a massive institution failing, we look for that one specific iceberg.
Oh, absolutely.
We want to point at a chart and say, like, there, that's the bad acquisition. That's the quarter the stock tanked. But today, we're stepping away from that neat binary world of modern finance. We are wading into the murky, terrifyingly complex waters of a sprawling family empire in freefall.
It is incredibly complex.
So welcome, everyone. Whether you are catching up on classic literature, prepping for a high-stakes meeting on organizational management, or you are just insanely curious about the mechanics of how a seemingly invincible institution actually rots from the inside out, you are in the right place.
You really are. And we have an incredibly rich source text today to guide us through this.
Yep.
We are focusing on Chapter 110, specifically from Kausuikian's monumental classic, Dream of the Red Chamber.
But let me just stop you right there, because I know exactly what some of you were thinking. An 18th century Chinese novel. Isn't that just like a bunch of poetry, romance, and tea ceremonies?
Right, that's the stereotype.
Exactly. But throw that assumption out the window. Our mission today is completely different. We are not reading a romance.
No, not at all.
This chapter is a brutally detailed mechanical case study on toxic workplace dynamics. It's about the absolute failure of executive leadership and, well, the weaponization of grief.
It really is a masterclass in dysfunction.
We're looking at what happens when the ultimate CEO, this family matriarch, who held a multi-generational operation together through sheer force of will, closes her eyes for the last time.
And it's arguably one of the most accurate depictions of systemic decay ever put to paper. Like, Cao Ishu strips away all the silk and glamour of the Qing dynasty aristocracy.
He really does.
And he just leaves us with the raw, terrifying logistics of an impossible situation. We are going to see how the burden of a failing system always, inevitably, crushes the middle managers who are left behind.
So let's set the scene with Section 1, which is the final appraisals of Grandmother Jia.
Also known as Jia Mu. So she is 83 years old. And she has been the unquestioned authority in this impossibly wealthy, politically connected family for over 60 years.
60 years. Just pause on that for a second. A 60-year tenure as the head of an aristocratic household isn't just a long career. I mean, it's an entire era.
It was multiple eras.
Exactly. To put that in perspective for you, she has outlived emperors. She has seen multiple generations of her own family born, married, and die. She has managed unfathomable fortunes, navigated these treacherous political tides at the imperial court, and she's basically acted as the ultimate judge, jury, and executioner for disputes within a compound that houses hundreds of people.
It's a small city, honestly.
Yeah, and now she's in her final moments.
And you have to realize those final moments are heavily orchestrated. Because in a highly traditional Confucian society, the deathbed isn't just a place for private goodbyes. It's a stage. It's the final transfer of authority, the last chance to issue directives. So the matriarch is surrounded by the family, and she begins giving what essentially amount to final performance reviews.
Let's unpack who she singles out, because the strategy of her deathbed speech is fascinating. First, she looks at Bayou. This is her grandson. He's famously spoiled, incredibly protected, basically the absolute apple of her eye.
Oh, entirely.
And her final words to him are, make something of yourself.
Which, if you think about it, is a devastating thing to say to your favorite child on your deathbed.
Why is it devastating, though? It sounds like standard advice.
Well, you have to understand the mechanics of Baoyu's life up to this point. Grandmother Jia used her absolute authority to build a fortress around him. Like, she shielded him from the harsh, pragmatic demands of his Confucian father, Jia Zheng.
Right, she let him just hang out and write poetry.
Exactly. She allowed him to live in this poetic, aesthetic bubble among the women of the household. So when she suddenly tells him to make something of yourself at the very end, it's not inspirational. It's a confession of failure.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. She is realizing that her protection has left him entirely unequipped to survive the brutal reality of the empire that is about to collapse on his head.
So she basically built a greenhouse for a delicate flower. And her dying thought is, oh no, someone is going to turn the heat off tomorrow.
That is a perfect analogy.
Yes, that's rough. Then she turns to her great-grandson, Jia Lan, and tells him to bring glory to his mother, Li Wan. But the most crucial interaction is when she gets to Feng Ji. Let's talk about Feng Ji for a minute.
We have to. She's central to all of this.
She is the operational manager of the household. So if Grandmother Jia is the CEO and chairman of the board, Feng Ji is the COO. She runs the day-to-day logistics. And Grandmother Jia looks at this brilliant, ruthless young woman and says, my child, you are too smart. Cultivate some blessings for your future.
The phrasing there, too smart, it just carries so much weight. In the context of the Jia family's operations, Feng Ji's intelligence hasn't been used for philosophy or art. It has been weaponized.
Right.
To keep this massive, bloated estate functioning, Feng Ji has had to be ruthless. She's manipulated loans, she's been physically abusive to servants, she's hoarded power, and, you know, she's made countless enemies.
And the bitter irony here is that Grandmother Jia implicitly sanctioned all of it, didn't she?
Oh, 100%. She relied on Fenji's ruthlessness so she could keep her own hands clean and maintain her image as this benevolent matriarch.
Wait, so she uses Feng Ji as her attack dog for years, reaps all the benefits of a well-run house, and then on her deathbed is like, hey, you should really work on your karma. I mean, that is incredibly hypocritical.
It is deeply hypocritical, but it also shows Grandmother Jia's late stage awareness of the karmic and social toll that kind of relentless pragmatism takes. Like, she knows the system she built requires brutality to function.
Right.
But she is warning her top executive that without the matriarch's protection, that same brutality is going to get Feng Ji killed. She's basically saying, your aggressive tactics worked while I was here to shield you, but the moment I am gone, those tactics will destroy you if you don't find some grace.
That is a chilling warning. And the matriarch doesn't just hand out warnings, right? She airs her final grievances. Like, she complains that Uncle Shi and Cousin Zen, two of the most senior men in the family, are out drinking and having fun instead of being at her bedside.
Yeah, the men are completely absent.
And then she explicitly calls out another relative, Shi Xiangyun, saying she has no conscience for not visiting.
And that detail about Xu Xianyin is critical for understanding the culture of silence in this organization. Because the source text notes that the other women in the room know exactly why Xu Xianyin isn't there.
Which is?
They know she's dealing with a catastrophic personal tragedy. Her new husband is dying of tuberculosis.
Oh my God.
Yeah. But no one speaks up. No one corrects the dying matriarch.
Why not? I mean, why let an old woman die angry at someone who clearly doesn't deserve it? That makes no sense.
Because in a pure autocracy, you do not contradict the supreme leader, especially not on her deathbed. The truth is just less important than maintaining the hierarchy. So they let her die with a false resentment rather than risk disrupting the engineered peace of the room.
I have to push back on the whole premise of her leadership, though.
Right.
Because I'm reading this, I'm looking at her 60-year tenure, and I'm thinking, you know, if she was such a legendary, incredible leader, why does the family immediately start fracturing the second her breathing changes?
That is the million-dollar question.
Right. If you build a truly strong institution, it survives your departure. A good founder builds infrastructure. Did she actually build a resilient system? Or did she just build a massive cult of personality that only functioned because everyone was terrified of her?
I think you've hit on the core tragedy of the entire novel, honestly. She absolutely built a cult of personality. She ruled through charisma, emotional manipulation, and unquestioned traditional authority.
So no real structure.
None. She didn't empower middle management. She hoarded power at the very top. She didn't establish sustainable financial practices. She just threw her personal weight around to patch the holes. And you can actually see her own panic about this failure in her final moments.
You're talking about the spiritual ledger.
Exactly. The source mentions her sudden, acute spiritual anxiety right before the end. She openly admits she didn't do much fasting or chanting in her life. She was too busy running an empire.
So suddenly she's cramming for the final exam.
Yes. She's desperately asking if the copies of the Diamond Suture she commissioned were actually distributed to the poor to generate good karma.
And for those who might not know, the Diamond Suture is a highly revered Buddhist text, and paying to have it copied and distributed was like a standard way for wealthy individuals to buy spiritual merit. It's essentially the ultimate PR move for the afterlife.
Right. And her sudden obsession with it speaks volumes about human nature. Because here is a woman who has wielded absolute secular authority for decades. She could order a servant beaten, she could arrange a marriage, she could dictate the finances of hundreds of people.
But none of that matters now.
Exactly. As she faces the void, none of that secular power translates. So suddenly, she wants to check the receipts on her spiritual transactions. She wants to audit her own soul to ensure her legacy in the next world is as secure as it was in this one.
It's literally like, wait, did my PR team send out those charity donations? Did my karmic check clear? It is a panic attack at the edge of eternity.
It really is.
But of course, it's too late to change the ledger.
Yeah.
She passes away, reportedly smiling, at 83.
Hmm.
And that peaceful, smiling death is the absolute last moment of peace we are going to see.
The very last.
Because the transition from a quiet deathbed to absolute unhinged chaos is instantaneous. And it all hinges on one question: who is left to pick up the pieces? Which brings us to section two, the power vacuum and the glass cliff of middle management.
This is where it completely shifts gears. We move away from the emotional family drama, and we step directly into a rigid, terrifying study of logistics, public relations, and resource management.
So Grandmother G is dead. Word reaches the imperial court. And because of the family's deep ancestral merits, they've been loyal servants to the throne for generations. And because they have a direct connection through an imperial concubine in the palace, the emperor himself gets involved.
Right, which is a huge deal.
He bestows 1,000 taels of silver for the funeral expenses. And critically, he orders the Ministry of Rites to oversee the sacrifices.
We really need to unpack those two details because they set the trap that is about to spring on Feng Ji.
Okay, let's start with the silver.
Right, the 1,000 taels of silver. So a tael is a measure of silver, roughly an ounce. To a commoner in the Qing dynasty, 1,000 taels is unimaginable wealth. It is enough to buy vast tracts of land and live comfortably for a lifetime.
Sounds like a lot.
But for an aristocratic funeral of this magnitude, it is a symbolic drop in the bucket. It won't even cover the cost of the mourning fabrics for the hundreds of guests.
Oh, wow. So it's basically the equivalent of the CEO dying, the board of directors sending a $500 gift card for catering and saying, make sure you feed the entire company, the press, and the mayor. Good luck.
Precisely. It is an honor that functions as a financial burden.
Yeah.
And then there's the Ministry of Rites.
Right. The government oversight.
Yeah. This is the government department responsible for state ceremonies, protocol, and managing the aristocracy. By ordering the Ministry of Rites to oversee the sacrifices, the emperor has just turned a private family funeral into a high-stakes state performance.
So they are being audited in real time.
Yes. Imperial auditors essentially will be watching every single move. If the funeral is perceived as cheap or disorganized, it's not just embarrassing. It's an insult to the emperor's gift. It could lead to the family being stripped of their titles.
So the outward prestige of the Jia family is still astronomically high. To the outside world, they're royalty. The expectations are set at this staggering height. But inside the compound, the reality is a logistical nightmare.
The total nightmare.
Let's look at the leadership void that opens up the second the matriarch dies.
Hmm.
Who is going to run this state-level event? You look at the senior men. Jia, she is physically away. Jia Zheng, the eldest present male, is a scholar. He knows poetry, he knows Confucian ethics, but he is entirely inexperienced in household logistics.
Right, he wouldn't know what to do.
He wouldn't know how to order 50 pounds of pork if his life depended on it. And Jia Zheng is stuck outside the inner household gates managing external affairs.
Which leaves this massive structural hole in the center of the organization. The men possess the formal authority and the titles, but they possess zero operational capability.
So who does the entire crushing weight of this imperial-level event fall on? Feng Ji, the female middle manager.
It does, and this is a textbook historical example of what modern organizational psychologists call the glass cliff.
Yes. For anyone listening who hasn't heard this term, the glass cliff is a phenomenon where a woman or a minority is suddenly elevated to a highly visible leadership position, but only during a period of extreme existential crisis.
Exactly.
They aren't handed a healthy company. They are handed a sinking ship when failure is practically guaranteed. Think about your own career for a second. Have you ever been handed a massive project, told that the entire department's reputation depends on it, but then given absolutely zero budget and a skeleton crew to execute it?
It happens all the time.
You aren't being set up to lead. You're being set up to be the scapegoat. That is the glass cliff. And Fengji is shoved right off the edge of it.
And the brilliance of the source text is that it doesn't just describe this in vague emotional terms. It gives us the exact terrifying numbers to prove how impossible Fengji's situation is.
Oh, the numbers are wild.
She takes an inventory of the staff she has available to run this multi-day, politically sensitive event. Remember, they have to host princes, princesses, high-ranking bureaucrats, and their entourages. They have to run continuous banquets, manage round-the-clock morning vigils, secure the compound, and coordinate hundreds of carriages.
It's massive.
So what does she find when she counts her team?
21 male servants, 19 female servants, and about 30 maids.
70 people total.
70 people to run an event that realistically requires 500 to 1,000 staff members. It is catastrophically inadequate. If you've ever tried to plan a wedding for 200 people, you know you need caterers, ushers, security, setup crews.
This is way bigger than a wedding.
Right. Fengji has 70 exhausted, underpaid staff members to serve the highest echelons of the Qing Dynasty government.
It perfectly highlights the terminal gap between their outward prestige and their internal decay. The Jia family still commands the emperor's attention, but they literally do not have the manpower to perform the identity they are desperately clinging to. The machinery of the house has just ground to a halt.
So a logical modern listener might be thinking, hold on, they're aristocrats. They have vast estates. They just got silver from the emperor. If you don't have the staff, just hire temporary contractors. Throw money at the problem. Bring in outside caterers.
That would be the logical move, yeah.
Well, that perfectly logical thought leads us directly into one of the most explosive and revealing parts of this entire narrative. Section 3, the battle over the budget. Because when an organization is failing, the first thing people fight over isn't the vision for the future. It's whatever cash is left in the vault.
And the fight over this specific budget isn't just about accounting. It's a proxy war between ideology, emotional loyalty, and sheer terrified self-preservation.
We have three completely conflicting agendas colliding here. First, let's look at the emotional loyalist, Yuan Yang. She was Grandmother Jia's most devoted, highest-ranking personal maid. She comes to Fengji literally in tears, begging for a grand, lavish funeral.
And her argument is really compelling.
It is. She says, look, Grandmother Jia left a massive personal stash of silver behind. She explicitly stated in her dying wishes that this money should be used for her rights. We have to give her the face, the dignity, and the send-off she deserves.
Right, because Yanyang's position is deeply human. For her, the matriarch's legacy is tied directly to the material display of grief. In her mind, if the funeral is cheap, it signals to the world that the family didn't love her, that her 60 years of leadership meant nothing.
So it's about translating love into money.
Exactly. It's a very common psychological response to loss, trying to quantify immeasurable grief through measurable expenditure. She wants to throw everything they have at one final, glorious tribute.
But then you have upper management stepping in. Jia Zhang, the eldest son, the man technically in charge of the big decisions, hears his proposal and says, absolutely not. And his justification is fascinating. He doesn't say, we can't afford it.
No, he takes a completely different angle.
He quotes ancient philosophical texts. He argues that according to pure Confucian doctrine, mourning should be about sorrow, not show. He advocates for a highly frugal, almost austere funeral to prove their deep traditional piety.
Which, on the surface, is a masterful PR spin.
It really is.
He's taking what might look like financial distress and rebranding it as moral superiority. It sounds like a wise traditionalist leader trying to rein in excessive vulgar spending and return the family to its austere, honorable roots.
Right. I'll admit, when I first read that, I thought, well, good for him. Somebody has to be the adult in the room and stop them from blowing the last of the inheritance on a massive party.
You'd think so.
But then we get the perspective of Jilian. He is Fengji's husband, and he's basically the cynical bagman of the family. He deals with the dirty outside finances. He pulls Fengji aside into the shadows and reviews the real reason behind Jia Zhang's sudden obsession with Confucian austerity. And it has absolutely nothing to do with piety.
It is purely about avoiding an audit.
Exactly. The family is terrified. Jilian explains that there are political rumors swirling in the capital. During a previous government raid on a related family, the authorities suspected that the Jia family helped hide illicit wealth.
Oh, that's dangerous.
Very. If the Jias suddenly throw a massively expensive multi-million dollar funeral, it's going to act as a flare gun to the imperial auditors. It will prove to the Ministry of Rites that they are still hoarding massive amounts of cash.
And the paranoia is entirely justified. Because in the Qing dynasty, aristocratic wealth wasn't secure. If the emperor decided you were corrupt, he could confiscate your entire estate overnight. They have seen it happen to their allies.
But the real kicker is what Jia Zhang plans to do with the money he's saving. He secretly plans to take Grandmother Jia's personal silver stash, the money Yuan Yang is begging them to use, and quietly use it to buy tracts of land down south, near the family's ancestral graves.
It's a fallback plan. It's an off-the-books asset transfer.
It's a golden parachute. He is literally laundering the funeral budget into southern real estate so that if the Imperial Guard kicks down the door and confiscates the mansion, the men of the family have an unrecorded cash-producing estate to retreat to.
It's so modern when you think about it.
It's modern corporate malfeasance wrapped in 18th-century robes. It's like a CEO moving company assets into an offshore shell company 2 weeks before declaring Chapter 11 bankruptcy.
What's truly insidious here is the hypocrisy of the mechanism. Jia Zhang is using the ideology of filial piety, which is the absolute core of their societal values, to mask his financial anxiety and his self-preservation.
He's weaponizing philosophy.
Yes. He is gaslighting the entire household. He is making Yuan Yang feel vulgar for wanting to honor the dead, when in reality, he's just stealing the dead's money to buy a lifeboat for himself.
Okay, I want to debate this for a second. I'm going to play devil's advocate. Is Jia Zhang actually a villain here?
Oh, interesting.
I mean, from a purely survivalist financial perspective, isn't he doing the right thing? He knows the ship is sinking. He knows an audit could destroy them. Isn't securing that southern land the only responsible move to ensure his children don't end up begging on the streets?
It's a brilliant question, and it really gets to the heart of executive decision-making in a crisis.
Yeah.
Yes, from a pure asset protection standpoint, securing unassailable land in the South is a rational survival tactic.
So he's right.
Well, the problem isn't the strategy. The problem is the secrecy and the delegation of consequence. He makes the executive decision to freeze the budget and hide the cash, but he doesn't adjust the operational expectations.
Ah, I see.
He still expects Feng Ji to produce an imperial-level funeral that won't embarrass them in front of the visiting royals. He gives her a budget of zero, but demands a million-dollar result.
That's the trap. That's the glass cliff mechanism in action. She is caught completely in the middle. Yuan Yang is crying, demanding a royal event, and threatening to expose that the family doesn't respect the matriarch. Jia Zhang has locked the safe and quoted Confucius at her. The Ministry of Rites is watching with a clipboard.
And she has nothing to work with.
Right. Feng Ji is just standing there in the courtyard with 70 exhausted, confused servants. Which brings us to the inevitable fallout. Section 4, the rebellion of the rank and file.
Because here is the iron law of organizational collapse. When upper management freezes the budget, hoards the cash, and expects the frontline workers to just pull off a miracle through sheer loyalty.
But workers notice.
Exactly. They notice, and they stop working.
We move from the theoretical arguments about money in the drawing rooms to the raw, physical reality of a labor strike in the kitchens. This rebellion is stunningly modern. Feng Ji is trying to organize the first major meal for the mourners and the arriving guests. She steps out, she issues the orders to the staff, and the servants just don't do it.
You have to understand how shocking this is. In a strictly hierarchical, almost feudal society, a servant openly defying a direct order from a senior manager like Feng Ji is historically unthinkable during normal times.
What would usually happen?
In the past, insubordination could result in severe physical beatings or being sold off to an even worse fate. It just wasn't done.
But they do defy her. They push back.
Yeah.
They stand their ground and say, we can't serve the food because the supplies haven't been released from the storeroom. We haven't been given the daily operating funds. They start faking illnesses.
Right. Suddenly everyone is sick.
They vanish into the sprawling compound to hide. They openly complain in the corridors that working for Feng Ji right now is a thankless task.
What you're seeing is the explicit breakdown of the social contract. The servants aren't stupid. They've seen the quality of the food declining for months. They know the family is out of liquid cash.
The staff always knows.
Always. They know the funeral budget has been artificially frozen by Jia Zhang. And most importantly, they know that they aren't going to be financially rewarded for taking on the massive extra labor this event requires.
It's the 18th century equivalent of quiet quitting, or even a wildcat strike. We like to romanticize the past, and think that servants operated purely out of feudal devotion and love for their masters. But this text strips that away. Loyalty is an economic transaction.
Absolutely.
When the paychecks stop clearing, or when the resources to actually do your job disappear, loyalty vanishes instantly. You can't pay your rent with aristocratic prestige, and these servants can't cook a banquet with no rice and no coal. I think we can formulate a rule here. Let's call it the law of mutiny. A strict hierarchy only works when the vault is full. The moment the money stops, the hierarchy becomes a suggestion.
That is incredibly accurate. And this mutiny forces Fengji into a position of profound systemic humiliation. Because she can't compel the servants with money, and she doesn't have the time to punish them, she has to scrounge.
This part is so embarrassing for her.
It really is. The text details a specific moment where she has to go to Yuanyang and literally beg to borrow Grandmother Jia's everyday dining sets, just her regular private bowls and plates to serve the guests.
Why? I mean, they live in a palace? Where are the thousands of plates they usually use for banquets?
Because she cannot access the family's official gold or silver dining services. And the reason she can't access them is because the family has secretly pawned them to stay afloat.
Let's stop and really absorb that mechanism. The Jia family, hosting princes of the blood, has pawned their silver plates.
It's the ultimate secret shame.
Pawning ancestral wealth is the ultimate sign of aristocratic death. It means you have zero liquid capital and you are eating your own infrastructure to survive the week.
Mm.
The manager of this great estate is scrounging for used clay plates just to feed the government auditors.
And the tragedy is that the guests know. In a society so deeply obsessed with face or material displays of status, serving a prince on a borrowed everyday plate instead of ancestral silver is a glaring neon sign that the family is broke. Fengji is taking the reputational hit for the men's financial mismanagement.
And if fighting a mutinous staff and scrounging for plates wasn't enough to break her, she is also dealing with active, malicious sabotage from her own upper management.
This is where it gets truly toxic.
Specifically, Lady Xing. Lady Xing is Fengji's mother-in-law, and she sits higher up the organizational food chain. She sees the absolute chaos in the courtyards. She sees Fengji drowning in logistics. Does she step in to help? Does she leverage her authority to get the servants in line? No. She intentionally refuses to lift a finger.
Lady Xing is playing a very dangerous, very petty political game. She wants Fengji to fail.
Why, though? Why ruin her own family's event?
Well, Lady Xing has always resented Fengji's competence and the power Grandmother Jia gave her. So now, with the matriarch dead, Lady Xing uses the crisis as an opportunity to let Fengji hang herself. She calculates that if Fengji completely botches the funeral, Fengji will be stripped of her managerial role.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, allowing Lady Xing to consolidate power in the aftermath.
Which is insane. She is actively destroying her own company's most important public event just to win an internal turf war against a rival manager. Think about how toxic that mechanism is.
It is the ultimate example of how toxic leadership trickles down. By withholding her support and actively radiating disapproval, Lady Xing sends a very clear, unspoken signal to the rank-and-file servants.
She gives them permission to rebel.
She is essentially signaling, Fengji does not have executive backing. If you disobey her, I will not punish you. And the moment the servants realize the executive board is divided, they feel entirely emboldened to ignore Fengji's authority.
So Fengji is trapped in a perfect storm of systemic failure. She has zero resources, a mutinous staff actively hiding from her, and a hostile executive board gleefully plotting her downfall. And she's trying to hold the walls of the mansion up with her bare hands. So while she is literally screaming herself hoarse in the courtyards, what is the rest of the family doing?
You'd think they'd be mourning.
You would assume that at a funeral, people would be, I don't know, mourning, focusing on the dead. But instead, they're putting on a highly complicated, deeply selfish performance. Welcome to section 5, the spectators and performative grief.
The mourning hall in this chapter ceases to be a place of genuine collective sorrow. It becomes a theater, a stage where everyone is playing a highly specific part designed to serve their own shit-in emotional or practical agendas.
Let's walk through the cast of spectators, starting with the astute observer, Li Wan. She's a young widow in the family. She's traditionally quiet, very pious, but her internal monologue reveals she sees the mechanical disaster of this funeral with crystal clarity.
She doesn't miss a trick.
She really doesn't. She has this brilliant poetic quote in the text. She looks at Fengji struggling and thinks, a good peony relies on its green leaves.
Meaning, Fengji is the bright flower trying to project beauty and control to the outside world, but she has absolutely no structural support from the family to hold her up.
The beautiful metaphor. But what does Li Wan actually do with this insight? Does she become a leaf? Does she step in to help Fengji coordinate the carriages or manage the kitchens? No, she is brutally pragmatic.
Extremely pragmatic.
She quietly orders her own personal servants to ready their specific carriages early, isolating her own resources, so she doesn't have to fight for borrowed transport later when the entire logistical system inevitably collapses.
Li Wan is executing the ultimate lifeboat strategy. She understands that the ship is going down. But instead of grabbing a bucket to help the COO bail water, she is quietly checking the straps on her life vest and securing her seat near the exit.
It's every person for themselves.
It's a devastating indictment of the family's complete lack of unity. When the pressure hits, they don't lock shields. They splinter into factions of self-preservation.
And while the adults are securing lifeboats, the youth are completely unmoored. You have Jia Lan, who is the only one actually sitting in a corner studying, rigidly adhering to what he's supposed to do. But then you have Jia Huan, a younger half-brother.
Oh, Jia Huan is terrible here.
The text describes him acting like a live monkey. During the most solemn moments of the rites, he is literally peeking through the white mourning curtains, ogling the young women in the hall instead of showing an ounce of respect for his dead grandmother.
Jia Huan's behavior highlights the complete breakdown of behavioral norms. In a functioning Confucian household, the patriarchs would severely punish that kind of disrespect instantly. But the patriarchs are busy hiding money, the managers are fighting over plates, and so the youth become feral. The cultural guardrails have completely dissolved.
But the most fascinating, and honestly the most heartbreaking, part of this section is what I call the hidden tragedies. The narrative camera pans across the mourning hall, and it focuses on the tears being shed. It looks like a unified display of profound grief. Everyone is crying.
It looks perfect from the outside.
Right. But Cao Weiken lets us hear their internal monologues, and we realize they are crying for entirely different, deeply isolating reasons. Take Shi Jiangyun, the girl grandmother Jia complained about. She is wailing hysterically. She's throwing herself into the mourning. Everyone in the room looks at her and thinks, wow, she's so devoted. She really loved the matriarch. But what is she actually crying about?
She is secretly weeping for her own doomed future. As we mentioned earlier, she recently married a man who seemed perfect, a wonderful match. But she has just discovered he has contracted consumption tuberculosis.
Such a horrible disease back then.
Fatal, basically. He is dying. She is standing at the funeral of an 83-year-old woman, but she is weeping for the imminent death of her young husband and the destruction of her own life. She's using the massive public funeral as a socially acceptable cover to release her private agony.
It's devastating. And then you look across the room at Bayou. He is also crying deeply, tears streaming down his face. But his internal monologue is entirely different. It's almost purely aesthetic.
Bayou is always about the aesthetics.
He's looking around at all the beautiful young women in the room, like Sue Bachai, who are dressed in these stark, pure white mourning clothes. And instead of thinking about his grandmother's legacy, he's romanticizing the visual. He's imagining how beautiful his lost true love, Lin Dayu, who died earlier in the novel, would have looked in this specific tragic aesthetic.
It's bizarre.
He's essentially directing a sad romantic movie in his own head.
You have to marvel at the psychological depth of the writing here. It is a profound observation on the nature of isolation within a collective.
Exactly. When I read this, I initially thought, this is like a reality TV show confessional. The camera's rolling, everyone is sobbing on the couch. But when the producer interviews them in the back room, you find out one is crying over a breakup, one is crying because they lost the challenge, and one is just faking it for airtime. But the more I think about it, that analogy almost trivializes it. It's much darker than that.
It is darker because it exposes the total illusion of the family as a cohesive unit. The text is showing us the mechanics of atomization. Even in a crowded room of mourners, packed shoulder to shoulder, participating in a highly synchronized state ritual, every single person is entirely alone.
There's no community there at all.
None. There is no shared experience of Grandmother Gia's death. The family hasn't come together. They've just brought their individual, private miseries into the same physical room. They are individuals trapped in the same burning building, crying over their own separate losses.
And all of these compounding pressures, the secret agendas, the total lack of resources, the uncooperative staff, the hostile executives, and the complete lack of any genuine emotional support, it all functions as a pressure cooker.
And it has to blow.
It finally detonates on the night of the vigil. We are reaching Section 6, the breaking point. This is where the psychological organizational trauma finally manifests as violent physical trauma.
This is the climax of Feng Ji's arc in the sequence. The gap between what she is required to do and the resources she has to do it finally snaps her biology.
Let's set the stakes for this final push. It is the day of the major night vigil. The pressure is at its absolute peak.
Yeah.
The Jia compound is packed with the highest ranking guests imaginable. We're talking the wives of imperial princes, top government officials, the Ministry of Rights is watching. Everything has to be perfect.
The stress must be unimaginable.
And Feng Ji has been stretched beyond the limits of human endurance. The text specifically notes that she has been shouting so much, constantly running between the kitchens, the courtyards, and the morning halls, trying to force this broken, mutinous machine to work, that her throat is completely raw. She can barely speak. She hasn't slept. She is running purely on adrenaline and the terror of public failure.
And critically, she is doing it entirely alone. The other senior women, the ones who should be sharing the load, have retreated behind the socially unassailable excuse of pious mourning.
They just sit there.
They sit in the hall, crying their isolated tears, leaving Feng Ji completely exposed on the operational front line to take all the friction from the guests and the staff.
And then comes the spark that lights the powder keg. It's the final insult. A young, low-ranking maid runs into the room where Feng Ji is briefly trying to catch her breath. Casually, almost carelessly, this maid repeats a vicious rumor that is currently circulating among the staff.
This part is so cruel.
A rumor that originated from Lady Xing, Feng Ji's mother-in-law. The rumor is that because the house is so chaotic and because guests are being neglected, Feng Ji must be hiding somewhere to relax and enjoy herself while everyone else suffers and does the hard work.
It is a masterstroke of psychological cruelty to take the one person who is literally bleeding themselves dry to save the family's public reputation and publicly accuse them of the exact opposite, of being lazy, selfish, and negligent.
It's the ultimate gaslighting.
It doesn't just critique her work. It entirely negates her sacrifice. It erases her reality.
When Feng Ji hears this rumor, the source details her physical reaction, and it is visceral and horrifying. Hearing this profound, inescapable injustice, after giving her absolute all, she doesn't just get sad, she doesn't just cry. She feels a massive, overwhelming surge of sheer anger.
Her body just rebels.
The text says her vision goes completely black. She tastes something sickly sweet rising in the back of her throat. And then she violently vomits bright red blood, collapsing right onto the cold ground, where her loyal maid, Pinger, barely manages to catch her.
It's one of the most shocking moments in the novel, and we have to view this through the lens of traditional Chinese medicine and classical literature.
Oh, that's interesting. What does it mean in that context?
Well, in that paradigm, vomiting blood isn't just the sign of, like, a stomach ulcer. It is the ultimate physical manifestation of extreme repressed rage and unbearable emotional trauma.
Just literally anger making her sick.
Yes. It signifies that the liver and the heart have been so overwhelmed by anger and injustice that the life force that literally reverses course and erupts out of the body, It is biology's catastrophic failure in the face of a toxic environment.
That explanation makes it so much more powerful. I read this and immediately thought of the ultimate terminal stage as corporate burnout. But this isn't just stress. Isn't this just being tired from working 80-hour weeks? This is her physical body violently rejecting the system. Is her biology saying, my mind might still be trying to manage these caterers, but my body refuses to process this injustice for one more second?
I think we need to coin another law here based on your earlier point. Let's call it the tragedy of competence.
Oh, I like that. Break that down. What is the tragedy of competence?
The tragedy of competence dictates that in a profoundly toxic or failing system, extreme competence isn't rewarded with promotion or support. It is punished with an impossible workload until the competent operator is utterly destroyed.
That is so true.
Right. Feng Ji wasn't destroyed by the work itself. She is a logistical genius. She could have managed that funeral with her eyes closed if she had a budget and a loyal staff. She was broken by the betrayal. She was destroyed by the office politics, the malicious sabotage from her own mother-in-law, and the profound gaslighting lack of appreciation from the people she was trying to save.